You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Welcome on Friday. Yeah, how about that? Nice. So, Mika Brzezinski called Mike Pompeo Trump's butt boy. Right? You won't have to search very far for the double standard in our society. Then watch this. Watch her not be held to a similar standard as anybody who's conservative would be held had they said something like that. Honestly, it is pretty amazing. You watch it on a regular basis and you see that and you're like, how does that work? How will they squirm out of this, right? How will they squirm out of this? And it's amazing. You watch it and, you know, people lose careers over stuff like that. She won't though, because they like her. She'll do whatever. It's like, what's that? Joy Behar. I mean, she says shit that you're like, whoa. You know, the things she said about the vice president, and, you know, she just keeps going. Why? Because it makes a difference. It makes a difference. Hillary Clump. You know, that's actually, she looks like a Hillary Clump. Hillary Clinton. You know what? That should be her name. That was brilliant in a crazy way. Hillary Clump. Because she's the same. My point was that she's the same as Donald Trump. But you can't get a liberal to admit that. A liberal will tell you that he is this new, the worst. And I had a run-in with one yesterday. And they just like, yeah, but like, yeah, look, I won't defend Trump. Okay? Like, he's got a track record of it. But so does she. Won't admit that, though. So, I mean, you say, look, that's the direction that's the gravitational pull of politicians. So, and then they just lose their minds. No, he's an abomination. He's the worst ever. He's this, he's that. No, they are the same class. And if you can't admit it, then you can't even have, we can't even have a discussion about it. And then the comeback is, if you can't see that Trump is the worst ever, then you're right. We can't have a conversation about it. Okay, then on to the next subject. How's Christmas going? And then they hate that too. Just like that? Well, yeah, we can't have a conversation. I mean, it's not like this is new to me. That in this country, for both sides, it only matters if it's your person or not. The truth doesn't matter anymore. And so, anyway, I was up late last night, cause I'm having problems sleeping. So I figure if I, I'm having problems with, sleeping. So I figure if I stay up later, then I'll sleep. And then slowly but surely I'll go back to my normal sleep pattern. So I was in getting ready to go to Camp Lejeune. I've been, one of the video pieces that I want to play is about, post-combat related mental health, about living with trauma is, you know, this thing that I talk about, which is why as in the military, why you keep your honor clean. And if you listen to the show, you've heard me talk about that, but I'll put it up later on today. There's a version of it on the All Marine Radio YouTube channel right now, but I've got to make a couple tweaks to it and then replace it. So anyhow, and it has to do with a guy from Mississippi by the name of Varnado Simpson. And Varnado Simpson, was a graduate of Brinkley High School in Jackson, Mississippi. His mother was an X-ray technician. This is in 1967. His mother was an X-ray technician. He's a black man. His mom was an X-ray technician in 1967 at a Jackson, Mississippi hospital, right? And I would tell you that, no small feat, living in the South, breaking through color barriers. He was attending Tennessee State College at Knoxville in his second year there. When he got drafted into the Army to get it over with. As fate would have it, he becomes part of Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry Regiment, which will be the company that executes the quote-unquote clearing operate, the search and destroy operation in My Lai, right? So I've been meaning to do this for a while, but he did two interviews that I've seen. He did one in 1970 when My Lai becomes public. Okay. A guy named Ron Rittenour was a member of Charlie Company, but had left Charlie Company before they went to My Lai. in March of 1968. So he then heard about it from friends, and at first he didn't believe it. And then, so he started not being too nosy, because he had heard that they had told people not to talk about it. But it came up when they'd be having a beer and drinking and stuff like that. And he then started collecting different accounts. He then put it all in a series of letters that he wrote to politicians, to the media, to the DOD. And that is really what explodes. That is really what explodes me live. So, and I want to say that's 1970-ish. So, Varnado Simpson is one of five soldiers in the company interviewed in 1970. And so, that video's out there. A BBC, or at least a British company, in 1988, for the 20th anniversary of the event, interviews him in his home in Jackson, Mississippi. And the interview, the video's, you know, incredibly, incredibly powerful. I'm going to play it here. I'm thinking of time. I might play it here. And so, what you see, and the reason I use it is, you know, with active duty guys, I do this thing called the mental health path of a warrior. And the Marine Corps teaches keep your honor clean, but I don't know that there's a better way to teach it than watching him. And, you know, for young Marines, soldiers, and when you give them that lecture, keep your honor clean, but you know what, they're like, whatever, man. You know, you don't want to get in trouble. And what they don't know is what you see in this video. As a 20-year-old young man with shit leadership in Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry Regiment, United States Army, he participates in something that will lead to his suicide 29 and a half years, 29 and three quarters years later. Something that he never gets over, something that he couldn't accept, something that tormented him forever. So, and the interviews are really powerful. In 1970, you see he's a bright young kid. You know, he's well dressed. He's in a suit and tie. You know, the rest of the world is losing its mind, right? He obviously got raised right, right? And then, well, Mac, how can you say that given what he did? Well, put yourself in his situation. You're 19 years old when you're a PFC in the United States Army. You're a rifleman in a segregated country, and you come from Mississippi. The white officers and staff NCOs appointed over you tell you that this is where we're going and this is what we're going to do. Would you have the moral courage and the confidence to say, no, I'm not? And when you hear him talk and he says, I don't want to do that, his platoon commander says, you know, if you refuse a direct order in combat, you can be shot. Now, I don't think anybody's doing that. But nonetheless, do you need more? Do you need, so we're the leaders that are supposed to know a little bit about the law of armed conflict. Where are they? Where are they that day? Where's every lieutenant? Where's every staff non-commissioned officer? Where's the first sergeant? Where's the XO? When Captain Medina says, every man, woman, child, dog, and cat that's in there is VC. Kill them. And you'll hear him say that. Now, I'll play this audio for you. It's about 18 minutes, the whole thing. And then, so that's the interview in 1970. He's a bright young guy. It's interesting when you watch the video, and it's on the All Marine Radio website right now. Not website, but the YouTube channel. I'll put a link up here so you can watch it later. But, you see him swallow hard during the 1970 interview. You can see the anxiety in his face. You can see him want to get emotional, or at least it tug at him. And then he keeps going in the interview. Now, so that interview takes place. And you can see there's certain things he rationalizes in statements. He makes the statement that, you know, were their children killed? Yes. And then later on he says, well, you know, the kids are just going to grow up to be VC, so why let that happen? I mean, you can see him clearly making statements trying to rationalize that what we did was right. 1970, fast forward to 18 years later, and he's a wreck. He's sitting in a chair in his home in Jackson, Mississippi, the same home where he will take his own life 9 years later with a gunshot wound to the head. He's just got out of the hospital after his third attempt to kill himself with drugs. And he's interviewed by this BBC company. So this would be 10 years after Mili, 9.5 years before he killed himself, something like that. And that interview is just chilling when he talks about what Mili has done to his life, how it affects him. They show the medications on the table. I've talked about this before. They show his picture of his son who was killed and by a stray bullet from an argument between two teenagers. As he held his son while he was dying, he knew that God had punished him for what he had done. And so you hear these just incredible things that he says about that experience. So I use that because, look, you can lecture people all you want, or you can pull the curtain back on life and you can say, I'm going to show you an example of what life is like if you don't keep your honor clean. And then I'm going to tell you that you keep your honor clean for you. So I was doing that last night. Okay. And then I was kind of rummaging through footnotes and blah, 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 blah. There's a guy by the name of Lawrence LaCroix or LaCroix. And I saw this letter that he wrote. So then, and it's in the LA Times, and I'll read you the letter here in a minute. It's a pretty amazing letter, written in 1993, so it would be 25 years after Mili. He lives out here in California, lives at the northern end of Los Angeles in a place called Sylmar, California. I read the letter, and then I'm watching the final version that I had done last night of the YouTube video. And so I'm watching it, and I hear the name. I hear Barnado Simpson say this guy's name. This guy, Lawrence LaCroix, was Simpson's platoon commander. And here's the letter that he wrote to the Los Angeles Times on March 25th, 1993. And I believe Mili happens on March 19th. I'm sorry, it's March 16th. 1968. So, as a participant, the title is Reflection on Mili. As a participant in Operation Pinkville, and as one of the contributors of information contained in Ridenour's original letter of complaint, and as the person who led the Inspector General's investigation to Hugh Thompson, the helicopter pilot I called to evacuate villagers, I would like to clear up some inaccuracies contained in Ridenour's perspective, as well as add some thoughts of my own. Now, remember, Ridenour is a guy who is essentially the whistleblower. Okay, he collects the accounts. He sends them to the DOD, the President of the United States at the time, Richard Nixon, the media, and he blows it up, right? The contention that, quote, we found no resistance is not entirely true. Albeit quite limited, for the first few minutes of the operation, we did come under fire from the village. And our platoon, commanded by Lieutenant Stephen Brooks, who was later killed in action, recovered weapons from bodies in the surrounding rice paddies after they had been killed by our helicopter gunships. When Ron talks of Task Force Barker, comma, artillery and helicopter battalions, comma, he fails to mention the participation of the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, national police, and local militia in the operation. All were present at My Lai, and all played a very large part in the massacre. 2 days prior to My Lai, Charlie Company Task Force Barker, my company, became trapped in a minefield. That day, two of my company were killed and 19 wounded, most losing a leg or a foot. We were frustrated, angry at our loss, and spoiling for a fight. We were led to expect it at My Lai. When a few minutes into the operation, it became apparent to some of us that there was no reinforced 48th Viet Cong Battalion, as we had been led to anticipate, it was already too late. The insanity had begun, and there was no way to stop it. Now, 25 years later, I have only recently stopped having flashbacks of that morning. I still cannot touch a weapon without vomiting. I am unable to interact with any of the large Vietnamese population in Los Angeles for fear that they might find out who I am, and because I cannot stand the pain of remembering or wondering if maybe they had relatives or loved ones who were victims at My Lai. I bitterly hate and no longer trust our military machine and our government, which employs it. I am sickened out of our continued involvement in wars in Grenada, Panama, Iraq, Somalia, and next, Bosnia. Finally, I disagree that there was no direct parallel between American conduct in Vietnam and the Holocaust. It's easy to see when you teach people to hate, when you teach that Vietnamese are not people, when you don't kill a gook but simply waste it. It was easy for us to turn away, easy not to get involved, just like most Germans during World War II. It was easy to put in the time until we got back to the world. Unfortunately, some of us will walk in the jungles and hear the cries of anguish for all eternity. Lawrence C. LaCroix. Now, I could be wrong about him being the platoon commander, but I thought that I heard in Varnado Simpson's, I thought I heard that, but I could be wrong. Anyway, that's a letter that appeared in the LA Times. I'm gonna reach out to that guy to see if he'd like to come on the program. If he's still alive, I'll have to track him down. So, we'll start the program, and then I want to play for you the audio from Varnado Simpson. And again, it's under the guise of, you know, in terms of teaching and the mental health thing. I don't want to give you a lecture that you're going to roll your eyes at and say, oh, you know, old dude lost his edge telling us not to, you know, whatever. No, that's not what I'm telling you. I'm telling you that if you go there, that you have to put your head on your pillow for the rest of your life. And sometimes that pillow can be a very, very uncomfortable place. And if you go there, it will be. I promise you. And you'll have to square yourself with it. Or not. And so let me pull the curtain back on somebody who couldn't square himself with what he did. Varnado Simpson. So anyway, I was working on that last night. So I figured I'd share the final work with you. Because what I had to do was, from a number of different interviews, attempt to put back the pieces that people had yanked out so that you could hear the interview. And then even in the segment that it's in, it's included in a, I can't remember how many hours it is, special or program called 4 Hours at Me Live. And so, so what I did was I had to edit the whole thing. I had to yank piece out, 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 put them all together, put the transitions in there, do all the stuff you do with video editing. And so I was working on that late last night. And so I'll play that for you. So on this Friday, Whitney Houston sings the national anthem. Good morning to you. Will the chef will join us here in a little bit. What else did I say? Merry Christmas to everybody out there. Happy holidays to the rest of you. And here she is singing our national anthem. And this is sadly dedicated to the five members of the C-130J crash that whose names were revealed in the last 48 hours after the search was the search and rescue is now deemed a recovery operation that's being executed by 3MF in the Pacific. So. This is dedicated to Lieutenant Colonel Kevin R. Herman, 38 years of age, Major James M. Brophy, 36 years of age, Staff Sergeant Max Alexander Flores, 27 years of age, Corporal William Ross, 21 years, Corporal Daniel Baker, 21 years old. All were killed in their KC-130 after it collided with an F-18 Hornet during a refueling training mission. So, this is dedicated to them, and fair winds and following seas to them, and as I said earlier this week, may God hold their families in his hand and keep that hand close to his heart. and this is dedicated to them as well.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
It defines us. It defines warriors like Gunnery Sergeant John Canley, a leader who led from the front. With his Marines outnumbered, he pushed forward during the Battle of Way City, standing tall during firefights and throwing himself into harm's way to keep his fellow Marines safe.
The only thing I was doing was just responding. The Marines, the young Marines, it shows them that it's not do as I say, it's do as I do. And just being that close with them brings motivation to them.
During firefights, when we'd be all hugging Mother Earth, he'd be standing up directing us. And I think if you talk to every Alpha Company Marine, we're amazed that he was never shot.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, he goes, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain, it's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once them bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
Once you're out of the Corps, you know, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful, and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me, I'm a poor veteran, or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, you know, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country. We care about what happens to everyone. Marine Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
I love that word, well, goodness. Well, goodness, Mike. I need to get Jack Riley on the program again. I got to call him. Wish him a Merry Christmas. Time for us to check the marine weather around the world. Currently in Quantico, the crossroads and the off-ramp of the Marine Corps. It is cloudy and 42. In Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, where I'll be in 3 weeks, raining at 56 degrees. Granbury, Texas, raining at 43 degrees. 29 Palms, cloudy and 43 degrees. Camp Pendleton, clouds and 45 degrees. In Okinawa, dark, cloudy, and 65 degrees. In the Anbar Province, clear, dark, 57 degrees. In the Helmand Province of Afghanistan, it is clear, dark, and 50 degrees at the home of All Marine Radio. Costa Mesa, Newport Beach area of Southern California, it is cloudy and 51 degrees. Looking for a high of 68 degrees today with no chance of rain. Lows into the 40s overnight, and that's the way it's looking for the weekend. So, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. You'll hear Barnado Simpson. Yeah, and you'll hear him, and in kind of an 18-minute audio montage that I was able to put back together after people had broken it apart. So don't touch that dial. I think you'll find the whole thing extremely interesting. You've heard snippets of it before, but it's tragic when you listen to this because his life was destroyed by the leaders that led that company, from this company commander who didn't know what the fuck he was doing, to the lieutenants who didn't stand up and say, "This, sir, this is wrong," who didn't put an end to it when it started, to the staff NCOs. He was let down by all of those. He was a second-year college student in 1967 when he joined when he left college to join the Army. Why didn't he take a college deferment? Why didn't he? I don't know if those were available when you're black in 1967. Oh, no, you don't remember. If you didn't live during that period of time, you don't remember. And if you didn't go to the South, you don't even know. So, anyway, to me, he stands as an extremely tragic figure. His life, his only life, he gets crushed by his own actions, at the pointy end of a company that's completely misled. And when I say misled, I mean led in terms of leadership, right? Not just lied to, led in terms of leadership. So we'll go there. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it, the McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to my dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King. Peace on earth and mercy mild, God and sinners reconciled. Joyful,
Amy Grant.
Nations rise, join the triumph of the skies. With angelic hosts proclaim, Christ is born in Bethlehem. With angelic hosts proclaim, Christ is born in Bethlehem.
All right, I feel kind of bad playing this after playing that, but... hey, it is the Christmas season. I play this so you can hear it all, but this is in the context I've been working on it as, why do you keep your honor clean? And to communicate to young Marines, in this case, in 3 weeks, you keep your honor clean for you. And I would extend this to any police officer, use it, show it to your peers. You have to put your head on your pillow at the end of the day. And so your actions throughout the course of that day, any day that you work, and it's hard because it's not always easy, you know, and some of the situations you find yourself in, you can't be as squeaky clean as you want to be, right? But at some point, you risk your health, in particular, your mental health for the rest of your life. And you have to know where that is. And you have to be able to do it. Because it's not all black and white. So, it's a million shades of gray. So this is Barnado Simpson. The first part of the video shot in 1970. After the Ron Ridenour stuff had come out.
To five of the American soldiers who were at My Lai on March 16, 1968.
Hold on. Let me recock this. I screwed it up.
We spoke to five of the American soldiers who were at My Lai on March 16, 1968. They were James Berthold of Niagara Falls, New York, Gary Garfolo of Stockton, California, Gary Crosley of Del Rio, Texas, Bernardo Simpson of Jackson, Mississippi.
All buttoned down, good-looking young Americans. And then there's a placard that comes up that I put into this video. Private First Class Barnado Simpson was born on October 7th, 1948. He died May 4th, 1997. PFC Simpson was a U.S. Army soldier, participated in the My Lai massacre on March 16th, 1968. He was 19 years old at the time of the incident. He was racked with remorse after the killing. After three unsuccessful attempts, Simpson succeeded in taking his own life at his home on Sunday, May 4th, 1997. He was 48 years old and died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head nearly 30 years after the incident at My Lai. So there's about a 15-second pause so that people can read that placard I inserted in there.
He was New York. He was from New York by the name of Rocker. And he was walking. I was walking point. I was walking in front of him. And I think I was about 10 or 15 feet in front of him. And I stepped in the same area he did. And as I approached the bush, I heard something go up and it knocked me down. So after the dust and all the brush cleared away, there wasn't anything left of him. He was totally gone. We had got led into the field by this officer, supposed to know where he was going, supposed to be reading the map, and he couldn't. Well, there was no certain age not to kill. There was everyone to kill. And it was in My Lai, or My Lai, or something, or something like that, something like that. And this afternoon, a week after, we had this orders. Our captain, Medina, was telling us about he was going in and burn down and kill everything that was in the village. And that we would leave nothing standing. That's women, children, babies, cows, cats, anything. And that morning, about 7 o'clock, we boarded the choppers and we went into the village. And when we got off the chopper, we started shooting. And I remember from the first incident, as I was coming up on an area, there was a man got up with a weapon and ran into a hamlet. And this lady got up and she ran and turned and had her back turned to me. And my platoon leader, Lieutenant Cross, told me to shoot her. And I said, no, well, you shoot her, man. I don't want to shoot no lady, you know. So he said, well, I'm giving you a direct order to shoot, and if you don't shoot her, that you can be shot yourself. So as she'd been putting her foot in the door, I shot her about 5 or 6 times. And I went there and turned over, and there was a little 3-month-old baby on the arms, which I thought it was a gun, you know. It just kind of cracked me up.
Was the baby dead?
Yes, it was dead.
The bullets had gone through her?
Yes.
Then what happened after that?
Well, after that, we had gathered about 5 prisoners, and they told us to guard us. And then here come one of the guys in my squad, said, well, let's kill him. So the platoon leader said, well, I'm turning my back, so I don't see what you're doing. And this guy had an M79, a grenade launcher, and you can't shoot a grenade launcher into a group because you can blow up yourself. So he grabbed my rifle and just went to the heads of everyone and put it between their eyes and just pulled the trigger.
And from there, it sort of grew.
Yeah, it grew on. And they said, well, my platoon leader told me, he said, my officer, the lieutenant said, well, go in and kill everyone. If you don't kill everyone, I'm going to watch you all day. And if you don't kill everyone, then you can be shot yourself. So as I went in, he was always near me anyway. So I think I killed about 18 or 20 people. And,
were any of these people children?
That was 2. Yes.
And the rest of them were all men?
Well, between ages, young and old.
Young and old. Did you see what else was going on in the hamlet?
Oh, yes. I saw Lieutenant Kelly when he said about this grave that they had, this massive ditch. I think it was about 50 people at a time. They would put 2 machine guns on each side and put 2 people with rifles, automatic rifles. And he was standing over them, and he said, shoot them. So he just killed all of them, all 50 of them. And then they would make another pile of them, put them in a ditch, and they'd get another 50 and shoot them and do them the same way.
Did you see any burning of the hamlets?
Oh, yes, we burned all the hamlets. Everything was burned out, yes. We put people in the hamlets and killed them and burned them. Well, they figured that the babies, when they grew up, they will be beasts anyway. So why give them an opportunity to grow up? Well, it was mutilate the bodies and everything, you know. It was hang them or something like this, or scalp them, anything. They really enjoyed it, cut their throats. Well, at night, well, we said, everyone was talking about how many they killed and all this, you know, how they killed them and everything. Once we got back, they told us not to talk to anyone. Well, our platoon sergeants told us not to mention this to anyone, not to say anything about it.
What do you think a war crime is?
What do I consider a war crime?
Yeah.
I consider a war crime of being over there. Just the idea of being there.
And then the following interview takes place 20 years after My Lai. So in 1988, I'm not sure it's the BBC or if it's just a British broadcasting company interviews him 9 years after this takes place, he will take his own life.
Can you tell me, Bernardo, what this book is? Why you've kept it?
He's holding a binder, a three-ring binder with pages in it, and that you can insert pictures into, one of those. And there's articles and pictures of of Milai.
This is my life. This is my past. This is my present. This is my future. And I keep it, to remind me. But it's always there. This is it. This is my life. This is everything. This is the way I am. This is what made me this way. I see the enemy, yes. But who is the enemy? You don't have little kids over there that would shoot you or stab you in the back when you walk away. You know, who is the enemy? How can you distinguish between the enemy? The good or the bad. All of them look the same. That's why the war was so different. You know, it wasn't like Germans over here or Japanese over there. They all look alike, north and the south. You know, so how can you tell? I was 19 when I went to Vietnam. I was a rifleman specialist, fourth class. I was trained to kill, but the reality of killing someone is different from training and pulling the trigger. No.
So you knew when you went into the village that if you found women, old men, children, anything that was living, you knew that you were going to have to kill them that day?
From women and children to dogs and cats, yes. Yes.
So,
but I didn't know it.
The women's children, dogs, the cats. That's a quote from Captain Medina. He said that in the briefing they got the night prior.
That I was going to do that. I knew the women and children was there. But for me to say that I was going to kill them, I didn't know I was going to do that until it happened. I didn't know I was going to kill anyone. I didn't want to kill anyone. I wasn't raised up to kill. Now, she was running with her back from a tree line, but she was carrying something. I didn't know if it was a weapon or what, but it was a woman. You know, I knew it was a woman. I didn't want to shoot a woman, you know, but I was given an order to shoot. So I'm thinking that she had a weapon running. So when I shot and I turned over, it was a baby. You know, shot about three or four times. And the bullet just went through and shot the baby, too. You know? And I turned over and I saw the baby face where we're half gone. You know? And I just blinked. I just went. The training came to me, the programming to kill. And I just started killing.
What do you mean you just started killing? Did you go looking for people to kill or what?
You didn't have to look. It was there. They was trying to get away. But they was just there. It wasn't hard to kill. It wasn't hard to find anyone to kill. That day in my life, I was personally responsible for killing between 20 and 25 people. About 25 people. Personally. From shooting them, to cutting their throats, to scalping them, to cutting off their hands. And cutting out the tongue. I did that.
Why did you do all that? You didn't tell me. Why did you kill the man and do that?
I just went. My mind just went. I wasn't the only one that did it. A lot of other people did it. I just killed once I started the training, the whole programming part of killing. It just came out.
But your training didn't tell you to scalp people or to cut ears?
No. But a lot of people were doing it. So I just followed suit. I just lost all sense of direction, of purpose. I just started killing any kind of way I could kill. It just came. I didn't know I had it in me. But like I said, after I killed the child, my whole mind just went. It just went. And once you start, it's very easy to keep on. Once you start. The hardest part is to kill, but once you kill, that's become easier to kill the next person and the next one and the next one. Because I had no feelings or no emotions or no nothing, no direction. I just killed.
You lined up people? You were one of the people who was mowing down big groups of people?
A group of about 10. Yes.
What happened? Did you round them up? And...
we just round them up. Put them in a circle. And put me, a couple more guys, and just put the M16 on automatic. And just mowed them down. Just killed them.
Have you ever seen any photographs of the people you killed?
Yes.
Have you got those photographs?
I have photographs of the people I killed.
Which photographs are they?
A man, a child, a woman, and a baby.
How can you bear to look at those today?
Because this is my life. This is my life. Even if I don't open a book, I see it. In my nightmares. And if I never open this book, it's still there. How can you forgive? I can't forgive myself for the things, even though I know it was something that I did and something that I was told to do. But how can I forget that? I forgive. I can't. I live with it every day. It's easy for you to say, well, you go ahead with your life. But how can you go ahead with your life when this is holding you back? I can't put my mind to anything positive because it's always negative.
This is a guy named Ron Ridenour. Interviewed in 1988, and he's the guy who originally collected different accounts of the story. Didn't believe him at first. He had been in Charlie Company, got transferred out of it, but still in Vietnam, and then went back to Hawaii. And as his friends came back, he heard these stories of what happened at what was called Pinkville. And as I said, at first he didn't believe them. Then he started collecting them. And then he put them together, and Ridenour is essentially the whistleblower in My Lai.
These people were tortured by this. They were kids, 18, 19 years old. Most of them had never been away from home before they went to the service. And they end up in Vietnam. And in a moment, following orders in a context in which they've been trained, prepared to follow orders, they do what they're told, and they shouldn't have, and they look back a day later and realize that they probably made the biggest mistake of their life. There are only a few people who were in those circumstances who had the presence of mind and the strength of their own character that would see them through that circumstance. Most people didn't, and for most of them, even people that I personally just was stunned to discover that they'd made the wrong choice, they did. And they had to live with it. They have to live with it. And so do I. So do we all.
There's a part of me that's kind and gentle. There's another part of me that's evil and destructive. Very evil and destructive. There's more destructiveness in my mind than goodness. There's more wanting to kill or to hurt than to love or to care. I don't let anyone get close to me. The loving feeling or the caring feeling is not there.
And that was caused by Milai, you think?
That was caused by Milai. My little boy playing in my grandmother's front yard. Here in Jackson. At his grandmother's house. There were some teenagers across the street. Got into an argument. It was 14 and 15. And one went home and got a gun. And the other one just ran in the direction where my little boy was playing. And he shot him in the head. I was in the house. And I came out and picked him up. But he was already dead. He was dying. So when I looked at him, his face looked like the same face of the child that I had killed. And I said, this is the punishment for me killing the people that I killed. And when the picture that I had, they had his funeral. The guy back from the funeral that night, that's the way it cracked. And I left it like that. It just cracked.
How much of this stuff do you have?
I take 1,200 milligrams every 4 hours, four times a day, of drugs or medication. I have to take it. I need it. That's the only thing that held me somewhat stable. Not as nervous. I stay nervous, even with the medication. But if I don't take it, I go. I just go off. It's keep me under control. It helps me. Because if I don't, I may do something to someone. Even though I still have a tendency to think that of hurting someone. But the medication helps me, really helps me. But I have to take a lot of it. And it's strong. It's very strong.
Do you think this really dreadful condition that you're in, this terrible life that you're leading, do you think it's ever going to come to an end?
Yeah, when I kill myself. It ought to come to an end. Like I said, I tried suicide 3 times. Maybe the good Lord is not ready for me to go. Because I could have been dead with all the stuff I had taken and tried to. But eventually, it's not out of my mind. Like I'm sitting talking to you now. I can't promise that when you come again, I'll be here. Because before you came, I had to get out to the hospital from trying suicide for the 3rd time.
The good Lord doesn't appear to have treated you very well, to have put you through all this.
I still believe in him, but I guess life, you live a life for a reason, for a purpose. Now, what that purpose is to have me still here, I don't know.
Are you ashamed? Oh, sorry for what you've done.
Yes, I'm ashamed. I'm sorry. I'm guilty. But I did it. Now, what else can I tell you? It happened. You're looking at someone that did it. It can happen if you go to war. Those are the type of things that will happen. It can happen to anyone. After they train you and they program you, it can happen. It happens. That's reality. That's what war is. War is not something that I shoot at you, you shoot at me. Well, we take time out. You know, well, don't shoot me here, don't shoot that. The war is war. It's killing all type of ways. And that's where we don't need another war.
That's the end of that. Barnado Simpson, that's in 1988. 9 years later, he will commit suicide. And this time, not with drugs, but with a gunshot wound. You can hear in that, first of all, I would tell you, as somebody, as a military guy, as a Marine, right? And he knew better, right? He said he didn't want to do it. And then he got told by whoever he said that to. And it sounded like he says LaCroix. But anyway, he says, I don't want to kill a woman. And he gets told, if you don't follow orders, you could be shot. And then later on, they talk about this programming. Well, his programming, his brain told him not to do it. But then essentially he got ordered to do it. Now, how do you explain the excesses? The scalping, the hanging people from trees and stuff like that. You can't. You can't. And the only thing you say is like just a complete utter failure of leadership. And again, he's 19 year old at the time. He knows better. And some of the guys in that unit, right, did not participate in that, would not. When they said, I won't do that, and got told you could be shot, they said, then shoot me. I won't do this. And it's a pretty atypical person in it. Pretty atypical person in that. Anyway, we'll take a break. I want to share that with you because that's part of trying to educate young Marines on the mental health path that you'll travel as a warrior. To pull the curtain back on the life of Varnado Simpson. To show them that there's a reason why you keep your honor clean. There's a reason why somebody put that in the song. First to fight for right and freedom and to keep your honor clean. But the reason you do that is for you. That the Marine Corps, the Department of Defense, and the citizens of the country are collateral beneficiaries of you doing it the right way. The primary beneficiary is you. So that when you come home, you can put your head on your pillow and you don't have to live anything close to what Varnado Simpson lived. It's important. So anyway, mental health starts with doing the right thing and not having that in your closet. So we'll take a quick break. The chef will join us next here on this Tuesday, the 14th day of December, 10 days to Christmas Eve. That's right. Better get out there and do your shopping.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.